Air. Tonight is a very special night. It's an author-to-author presentation. Guest host tonight is Matt Coyle. We'll be right back, and I'll tell you all about it. This is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Occasionally, I am lucky enough to have authors who will come on and take the microphone from me. Tonight is such a night. My friend, award-winning author Matt Coyle, whose new book, Dark Fishes, the third in his Rick Cahill series, is a bestseller already. It's fantastic. Has decided to come on and interview his colleague from Ocean View Publishing, David Putnam, who also has a new book out called The Vanquished. I'm going to turn the front radio over to Matt Coyle right now. Matt, have at it and welcome aboard.
Well, thanks for having me, Pam, and giving me the keys to the sports car. I hope I don't burn out the clutch.
It's all good.
Yeah, I'm sure it's repairable after I leave. But I want to thank you on behalf of a lot of authors for what you do for the mystery community, giving authors that maybe aren't that well-known the platform to be heard. So I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. I'm gonna turn my microphone off and have fun, okay?
All right. We'll see what happens. Okay, as Pam mentioned, I'm interviewing David Putnam, a sometime friend, the author of the Bruno Johnson thriller from Ocean View Publishing. Despite his ability to crank out books as quickly as Team Patterson, Dave hasn't always been a crime writer. He was actually once a real-life crime fighter. During his law enforcement career, Deputy Dave worked in narcotics, violent crimes, criminal intelligence, hostage rescue, SWAT, and internal affairs. He finished his career working in Hawaii for Hawaii 5-0. Welcome, David Putnam.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
You got it, buddy. Hey, say hello to your lovely wife, Mary, who I'm sure is holding cue cards right now.
Hello. As a matter of fact, she is.
I'm not surprised. I can feel the prompts coming. But I was a little concerned during this interview less than a week after Pam had our fellow Ocean View author Carter Wilson on. I don't know if you heard the interview, but the guy is truly the most interesting. He's the most interesting man in the world, and he's a lot better looking than you and I together. But this is radio, so we don't have to worry about that. But after I was reading your fictionalized bio, I realized, maybe we're okay because you're kind of interesting too. What exactly is criminal intelligence?
Oh, criminal intelligence is kind of like an oxymoron, too. It was a division of the Sheriff's Department that works as a liaison with a bunch of different intelligence organizations. So you took a lot of meetings, and then you would take in the information and disseminate it throughout the department to the different places that needed it.
So you were given IQ tests to criminals?
No, we're not doing that, no.
Okay, all right. But before we go too far, I know you offered to give away a signed copy of Book 4 in Bruno, The Vanquished, right, too, if we get the caller, if somebody's got nothing else to do and calls in.
Yes,
all right.
That's correct.
I'm gonna match that and give away a signed copy of Dark Fishers if we can actually get more than one caller. Anyway,
all right.
So this is The Vanquished, which is a really fast-paced, great book. It's the fourth Bruno Johnson novel. So tell us a little bit about Bruno, his background, and what he's up to in The Vanquished.
Bruno Johnson is an ex-cop, ex-con, and in the series he rescues children from hostile environments, mostly in the Southern California area. And then he runs back to Costa Rica to hide out from the law that is also chasing him. In The Vanquished, it's kind of a continuing story from book two. But what happened was I started out with three plot lines, and one plot line kind of took over the whole book. So the book did not turn out anything like what I had planned. But I was pleased with the way it came out, with the twist in it.
Why is, tell the listeners why, unless, you're not really giving away anything if you tell why Bruno is being chased by the law. I mean, that comes pretty early in book one, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, the FBI and the local agency, they're chasing him because he's taking these kids illegally, even though the kids are not, they're legally kidnapped, but they're not morally kidnapped. Bruno, when he was working as a deputy, he couldn't rescue the kids because the law restricted him too much. Now that he's not restricted by the law, he goes outside the law to rescue them.
Cool. So I find Bruno to be interesting and a complicated character for sure. Is he modeled after somebody you used to work with, or a composite, or strictly out of your own mind?
Bruno Johnson is an African-American character, and I took him after a friend of mine who I work with in South Central Los Angeles and a number of other deputies. I took their best attributes, and then I gave him quite a few flaws. If you read the book, that he's flawed. But when I'm writing him, I hear the voice of a couple of deputies that I used to work with, yes.
So do you ever, so how many different agencies do you work for? I know you had a hard time keeping a job, so how many different agencies did you work for?
I started out as a sheriff's explorer when I was 15, I think it was. Samuel County Sheriff's Explorer is like the branch of the Boy Scouts. Then when I turned 18,
why don't you explain what that is, what a sheriff explorer is?
A sheriff's explorer.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's this was out of the West End Sheriff Station for San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department, and it's run a lot like the branch of the Boy Scouts of America. And you'd show up and you'd wear uniforms, and there were deputies, full-time deputies that were people who ran the operation. And we would stand at attention, and we'd write reports, and we'd go on ride-alongs and that kind of thing. It was very good for my age.
So you were 15?
Yes.
How long did you do it?
I did that until I was about 17, I think.
Wow. So you liked having the power of the badge, messing people's lives
up,
huh?
Explorer didn't have any power, that's for sure. And then I went into Ontario Police Department, and I applied for a cadet, and it's like an intern. And as long as I kept my grades up at junior college, they let me ride as much as I want. So, but they didn't really monitor my my schooling. So I ended up working 40 hours in the office and then going on 40 hours a week ride along. So I was doing 80 hours a week as a police cadet.
So you're saying your grades are pretty bad?
Non-existent.
Oh, so you weren't even in class. Nice.
What?
Nice. Your whole career is built on a sham.
It is.
Well, you're not alone. You're not alone. Okay, so back to Bruno. We're in a kind of a interesting period. I don't want to get into social stuff, but do you get any pushback for being, I mean, you are as white as I am, which is really white. You're certainly in skin color. But so do you get any pushback of I don't know, people being upset with you writing an African-American protagonist?
Not yet. No one's. The only thing that has come up was at a book conference. Two different people came up and said, "Oh, I thought you were black," and they must have read the Kindle version because my picture's on the flap of the books.
Yeah, and it is. You're a white man.
Yeah.
You're a large white man.
I didn't get to finish that last question you had. From cadet, Ontario Police Department, I went to regular patrol officer. Went to the academy for him at 20. I worked there 4 years, and I wanted more action, so I laterally transferred to LA County Sheriff's, and I did 4 years there, and then I laterally transferred to San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department, and I worked 22 years there, and then I retired in California and went to Hawaii.
And San Bernardino County, isn't that the biggest county in the United States?
geographically, it's the largest county in the United States. It's 21,000 square miles. It goes clear to the Nevada border.
So if there's a some sort of sheriff necessity, say, east of what's that midpoint on the way to Vegas? Is that the little city up Barstow? East of Barstow, they would call you out.
If there was a SWAT operation, yeah, they would call us out, and they wouldn't give us an address. They would just page us out to the airport. And we'd show up at the airport, and they would helicopter us out to the location because it would take too long for everybody to drive.
You told me those helicopter rides were a lot of fun, right?
No, I did not like them at all. No.
Weren't you? You were telling me something. You were sort of hanging out there for a while, like hanging out in the air.
Well, when you have a whole team on the SWAT team and a Huey, there isn't a lot of room. So because I was so big, my spot was sitting on the bulkhead with my feet on the outside runner, what do you call it, the skid. And sometimes if we'd bank, somebody would grab onto the back of my vest and hold on to me.
You weren't even cabled in or anything?
No.
You are an interesting man.
And one summer we were going out to hit a meth lab, and we were flying real fast to the low desert from San Bernardino Valley, and the helicopter pilot thought that he was going to have enough elevation, and he didn't, and he banked at the last minute because he wasn't rising fast enough because of the heat, and he just yelled, "Hold on," and then he banked the helicopter, and that's one reason why I don't like flying helicopters.
All right, so back to Bruno. What would you say is his greatest strength?
His moral compass. I think he's got the right idea. He understands the difference between legally right and morally right, and he follows his heart mostly.
Does he ever break his own little moral compass code?
Not purposely. In The Vanquished, he does, and it was not on purpose at all. He was unknowingly.
Well, never mind. I was going to say, if he didn't know, he had to know at some point that he broke it. Right? I mean, how do you know if it's something moral?
And a publisher.
You're the judge of your own morality, right?
Right. Yeah. But still, even though he was unaware of it, and it wasn't intentional, it still is going to weigh very heavily on the next book.
Cool.
And in fact, the publisher even asked me how I'm going to pull Bruno back from that edge, because I took him right to the edge, and I decided I want three prequels first. And they just bought the first prequel, and I finished the second one, and my agent just 2 days ago gave me the thumbs up on the second one.
You're getting ahead of me. That's like my last question. But anyway.
Okay.
So you're writing the prequels because you don't know how to figure out the Bruno situation, right?
Well, I've got an idea on how to do it. It's just going to be very difficult because he is on that edge, that emotional edge, and I got to walk him back. And I think I could do it. I've got a scenario set up. I can pull it off, I think.
I know the feeling. So what would you say is Bruno's biggest flaw?
His weakness to help children and other people. Because
you go to a job interview, what's your biggest flaw? Well, I work too hard.
Yeah, he has trouble saying no, and Marie wants him to say no, but he can't.
Does he ever have any anger issues?
When you get him mad, yeah, you don't want to be next to him when you get him mad.
Yeah. It's a large fella. All right, so as I said in your intro, you worked a lot, as you just explained, you worked a lot of different things in law enforcement. How many true life events did you fictionalize in The Vanquished?
Well, you know, for the record, it's all fiction.
Of course.
I fictionalized some events in The Vanquished, and, you know, it's hard to tell. I don't keep track. I would say there's probably 50% of the events in that book are taken right from real stories.
Wow, shooting. 50%.
Yeah, the last book, the second prequel, I would guess that it's 80%.
It's second prequel. Is that the book that you just finished?
Yeah, well, it's a book the agent just gave the go-ahead on. So
okay.
The Vanquish is book four, and then I wrote the first prequel, which the publisher bought, and then the second prequel is what the agent just gave the go-ahead, and the publisher hasn't seen yet.
All right. So you said up to 50%, which I to me that's extremely it surprises me, and then 80% in your prequel. So clearly you don't have any original ideas. But what about the
yeah, that's right.
What about the other three? You know, of your four published books, what about the other three? How many? Like, what's the ratio there?
In Disposables, I think there are five incidents in that book that I took from real life, and then the Replacements. It was based on one very violent sociopath criminal that the team that I was on. We followed him around once he was paroled. And his name in the book is called Drago.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was going to talk about him later. But is the second book is called what? I mean, I read them all. But what's the second book called?
It's The Disposables is the first one. The Replacements is the second one. Drago.
Does Replacements have the opening scene of the bleeding house?
Yes, The House That Bled.
That's a great scene.
That was based on a true story. That I was actually there at that house, and I wrote it just the way I described it.
Yeah, that is wild. So now you told me the percentage is very high with all the stuff that really happened. You put in these books, of course, fictionalized. Are there things that happened while you're on the job that were either too personal for you to fictional to put in books, or maybe just too horrific or sad? Are there things you want to touch from your background?
I was writing for many years, and I wasn't having any luck. And I decided that I needed to put more emotion into my stories. So I actually decided to write things that were the most painful for me to experience in law enforcement, and that was dealing with the children. And that's when I started having success, was when I started describing the social situation that these children are caught up in.
So is it possible you back at your house in Temecula, there's about 12 kids that nobody knows about?
Exactly.
That's why I never come over.
I don't think you've ever been invited.
Oh, nice. Well, whatever comes, you know the answer. So you mentioned Drago, who is I think he what book did he come was he was it in two that he showed up the Replacements?
Book two, yes.
Drago, Carl Drago.
Yeah, book two he showed up.
Yeah,
and
he is a he's a go ahead.
And what happened with Drago? I didn't intend for him to turn out the way he did, but as a just like a hero, he can't be perfect, otherwise he turns into a caricature. So with Drago, he was such an evil person in real life and in the book that I had to give him some humanity or he would turn into a caricature. So I started walking him back from his evil ways, and everybody liked him so much, the publisher wouldn't let me kill him off. She wanted him in the future books.
So you just kind of mentioned something that is interesting to me. Of course, you in fiction, you had to give him a little humanity. Now, you dealt with, you said in real life, he was probably pure evil. So some of these very dangerous people you dealt with when you were a cop, did you find any humanity in them? Even some of the worst of the worst, was there any humanity? Like, as the woman who runs my writers group always says, Carolyn Wheat, you know, the villain in every story thinks he's the hero of the story. So to some of these people, these very violent, nasty people, did they think they were doing right, or was there any humanity in them that you could see?
Well, I chased murder suspects for a long time, and I didn't do the murder investigation. I just manhunted them after the warrant was issued for them. And the majority of them were heat of passion killers. And I can see, I can't accept it, but I can see how that would happen, where they killed somebody without laying in wait, without planning it, you know, that kind of thing. The guy that Drago represented in real life, he was just a straight sociopath, and he had no business being out in public. There wasn't one redeeming factor in that guy at all. So the
sociopaths
of those
are definitely different, for sure.
He'd committed.
Go ahead.
The real guy had committed two murders. He killed one person who went in for 25 to life. He got out on parole after 12 years. He killed somebody else. He went back in for 25 to life, got out for parole the second time after 12 years. So he'd been incarcerated for 24 years of his life. And they called my team and said, there's a high chance that this guy is going to be a danger to the public. So they put us on him.
So you called your team. What were you working at this? Were you working for the San Bernardino County?
Yeah, I was on a violent crimes team.
Violent crimes team. So why don't you tell the listeners what that means? What do those guys do? Pretty nasty stuff, I'm guessing.
Well, we got to pick our own cases, and we got to pick our own targets, and we would follow violent criminals around, sometimes actually bank robber crews. We'd watch them do a bank robbery and then take them down coming out. Or we would chase murder suspects that were a threat to the public, and sometimes we went after the 10 most wanted just because we had that autonomy.
You get to pick your own targets? This sounds like Vic Mackey from The Shield.
Yeah, it was a fun job.
Why do you get to pick your own targets? Is that something that any violent crimes unit was able to do, or because you guys were the elite, or Vic Mackey was running around,
we would be given assignments sometimes, especially assignments that were sensational and in the news, and sometimes a black eye for the department. They would pull us off what we were doing and redirect us. But a lot of times we were self-initiating kind of crew, and we just went out and took people down.
Was it Sean? What's the guy? Sean Ryan? Did he talk to you before he wrote the Shield?
No, the crew that I was on is not unique. Every agency, a lot of agencies have them. The larger agencies have them.
Yeah, that sounds a little dangerous to me. All right, so we mentioned Carl Drago. He is a fun piece of nasty. So you kind of explained where he came from. How did you put humanity into him and still make him a very dangerous guy?
You know, it was kind of tough when I decided to give him some humanity. The way I did it was Marie, Bruno's sidekick. You know, I write thrillers, and my wife makes me put the romance in them, so now they're called romantic thrillers. But Marie is sidekick.
They're called romantic thrillers? Who's calling them romantic thrillers? Is that what we're calling them?
Romantic suspense. Romantic thrillers. My wife just nudged me.
Yeah. I heard the cue card, yeah.
So I just had Marie confront Drago, and then Drago, as bad as he was, kind of backed off of his evilness toward Marie and actually kind of fell for her. So that showed a chink in his armor and made him a little bit of human.
It just showed he had a penis. It didn't show his humanity.
I didn't show him his penis?
No, I'm saying it just showed he had a penis. It didn't show necessarily humanity.
Oh, well, he was nice to her and went along with the program because of Marie.
No,
he wasn't for Bruno.
It does come through.
Bruno actually shot him in the leg to try to get him to go along with the program. He still wouldn't do it. And then when Marie came on scene, she was able to coax him like a, you know, calming a wild dog kind of thing.
Your wife just instant messaged me that the romantic thriller is a actual Amazon category.
Right.
All right, well, it's good. I'm talking to the team.
Yes, you are. She's my wingman. I tried to lock the door, but she had the key.
I'm going to describe this next author who blurbed your book the way a bookstore in an unnamed city once named him to him. Mostly unknown author said this about your book: bring an oxygen tank with you when you read The Vanquished, because you'll be holding your breath the whole time. Unrelenting action with more twist than a sidewinder trail. A lightning read. Okay, so, you know who that was?
Yeah, that was you. And I really appreciate that. That was a great blurb. Thank you.
All right, well, I just got the heads up that we're going to take a break because apparently we're boring the crap out of the audience. So hold on a sec.
You're not boring anyone. I think it's a great conversation. I just want to remind everyone that you're listening to Authors on the Air with special host Matt Coyle and guest David Putnam. We are ready for to take calls. If you want to give a call into these guys, please do. The number is 347-633-9609. Write it down, 347-633-9609. This is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Back to you, Matt. Thanks.
Thank you. By the way, I'm still waiting for the free copy that generally you give out when somebody burps your book. But anyway, so
I
kind of mentioned
earlier. I didn't realize that that was a
give the program. You owe a lot of people books, buddy. anyway, so you kind of mentioned earlier that you had three plot lines for The Vanquished, and one sort of took over, but it is a very twisty story. So did you envision having going at the kind of breakneck speed with so many twists along the way, or did that evolve as you wrote the book?
I don't plot the book out at all. I think you describe them as pantsers. I have an exciting incident.
I call them blank pagers. Everybody else calls them pantsers. Anyway,
okay,
sorry.
Blank pagers. I'm a blank pager. I have an inciting incident, and I know how the book is going to end, and I have no idea what's going to happen in the middle. So I wrote the inciting incident, and then just let the book take off as it went, and it kind of took over from what I had initially had three conflicts set up, and the one I thought was going to end up at the end didn't.
Your process is as effed up as mine. So apparently, Dave, we have a caller. Somebody's calling.
No way.
Is Mary on the phone? Could be my brother.
Oh, yeah.
So we have a caller from area code 612. Please say hello and state your name.
Hey, guys. It's Philip, and I'm calling from Fort Collins, Colorado. How are you guys tonight?
All right. Oh, it's just Donald.
Hello, Phil.
I'm loving the show, and you know, listening to both you guys talk is pretty amazing, and I'm big fans. But I've got a question, kind of separate from the books themselves, and I'm kind of curious about, and for both of you, what was your like first or best aha moment as a published novelist?
James,
mine. I was writing for 23 years. I had written 38 novels, 38 manuscripts before the publisher picked up number 34. So I had been kind of disillusioned and didn't think it was ever going to happen. But the morning that Michael Connelly sent me a personal email saying that he loved the book and it kept him up all night, that was kind of like a major aha moment for me.
Name dropper.
That would be.
That's amazing, Matt. What about
okay.
you? And
okay, you know what? I had one, but I'm going to give you a different one. It was the night that I won some award, and Robert Crace emailed me to congratulate.
The name dropper.
So you're a name dropper too, but that's fine.
Only because
You know, I think it's got to be amazing to be published and to be so successful and your heroes become your peers almost like overnight. Can you talk to me about that for those of us that relish thinking about those moments?
Ooh, you think a lot more of me than I do. I'm just a little peanut writer, still trying to make it in a hard world.
Well, you're bigger than a peanut. You're more like a cashew.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, Ocean View, you're both with Ocean View Publishing, that is what I'm reading here.
As are you with the Donovan Nash novels.
And you're known, and they're known as a small but kind of important publisher, and that there's no giveaways in this game. And so we're all playing in the big leagues here. But I love to hear the stories behind the behind the books, and that's kind of the reason for my call. So, yeah, good show, guys, I have to say. And, you know, if there's any other aha moments you have, I know as fans, we love to hear those.
Well,
thank you.
You know, for me, honestly, I didn't ride as long as Dave, because I'm faster and smarter, but it took me a long time to get an agent. And that to me was, I mean, as beautiful and wonderful was to get a publisher. I sent queries, hundreds of queries out and gotten rejections, or probably more like rejections up to 75. But when I finally got an agent, I just felt like, well, yeah, maybe I can do this. Anyway, Phil, before you go, when is the next Donovan Nash novel coming out?
The latest one, Seconds to Midnight, comes out March 7th. I'm excited about this. It's the seventh in the series, and the early press has been pretty good, and so it's
got a great review in Mystery Scene magazine.
You know, I like that. There's another one coming from Suspense magazine that we can't release it until the magazine comes out. But it's so you know the early buzz is exciting. It's pretty fun stuff, you know, when your book is going to come out. And I know what some of my aha moments are, and I'm always curious in what other authors are. And I appreciate you guys' candor and keep talking. You guys are great.
All right, thank you
for calling in. Hey, you know what? You have the potential of getting a free book signed by Dave, but we're gonna with so many calls coming in, we might have to like flip a coin or something. But anyway,
okay, now I understand. I've used up my time. You guys have a great evening.
Hey, thank you, Phil.
Okay, bye bye.
Dave.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, I was telling about some wonderful blurb he got from a really unknown author. So you gave me the answer to that. So, we kind of, Phil had some great ideas, as a matter of fact, but let's even go back further, the beginnings of when you when you thought about becoming a writer. I believe it was at the San Bernardino taxpayer's expense, right?
Well, you have a misinterpretation of that, and I think I've explained that to you a couple of times.
My mind has not been changed.
I was on a surveillance out in the middle of Cern Valley of a meth lab, and I always kept books with me, novels, for downtime. And it's not like in the movies or novels where everybody's watching the same place. You only have one guy watching, so you don't burn the operation. And everybody else is laid off someplace. So I had the opportunity to read a lot of novels and get paid for it. And some guys would play basketball or softball, and some guys had the small TVs, even back then, plugged into their cigarette lighter accessory. And I was down to my last novel, and it was a national bestseller, and I started reading it, and it was terrible. I couldn't believe how badly written it was. So I decided that I could do better, and I wrote the first four novels on legal pads in the front seat of my undercover car. And then I realized that a good author makes it look easy, and it took me a long time to build my craft.
Would you like to give out the name of that author that inspired you to write?
Oh, come on. There's no chance.
So you wrote, how many novels did you write before you were published? It's a huge number.
I was on number 38 when
38.
I published number 34.
That means Ocean published number 34, which was, yep, Ocean View, our publisher, wonderful,
yes.
Bob and Pat. Who apparently Phil was trying to up his next royalties or his advance by saying how great they are. If it worked, I'm gonna do the same thing. So they picked up 34. So that was the first Bruno book. Was it the first Bruno book you wrote?
Yes, it was, and it was at the time it was called The Other Side of Forever. But they thought that was too much of a romantic title.
Yeah.
And they changed it.
Is there a movie title that or something?
No, it was Outside of Midnight.
Okay. Go ahead.
So then I dropped what I was doing. I was writing novel 38, And as soon as they picked up number 34, the Bruno novel, I stopped what I was doing and I started immediately writing a sequel.
So the one Bruno you wrote was the only Bruno you had written at that time.
Right.
Cool. So, 38, wow. So how do you think your writing has changed since you had your head down writing longhand in your stakeout vehicle while multiple real-life Walter White slipped past you?
I never wrote while I had the eye. When my responsibility was... I think my first 20 books were all training ground, and they are not publishable, but after that, I think they have some merit. And that took me a long time to figure it out, probably because I'm dyslexic and I have difficulty learning.
You're dyslexic? So does that affect your reading? Just writing?
No, I can read quickly if I want to, but my writing, I'll be typing along, and I'll go back and reread stuff, and there's a bunch of red ink underlined because I put letters in front of... inverted the letters in a lot of the words, so I got to go back and click on it to correct them.
I do that too, but I think it's just old age for me. So you wrote all these books. You wrote 20 books that you thought were crap, and then you wrote maybe another 15 you think should already be published. So did you take any steps along the way to get better, aside from just continually writing? Did you take any writing classes? Because I know you're always going on and on about crafts, which I really don't know what that means, but I figured you picked it up somewhere.
I read some how-to books that I really liked and some that I didn't. And some of them, I think learning is just a matter of communication, and some people hit you right between the eyes, and a couple of books were just really made me vastly improve all at once, I think. One of them was the Techniques of a Selling Writer. To me, that is just a fantastic book. In fact, I like it so much, I bought the tapes, and I listened to it back and forth to work over and over again. I went to writers' conferences and sat in on panels and went to book conferences and talked to authors, and 23 years of that. We've been going Left Coast Crime, BoucherCon, Southern California Writers Conference, all kinds of different conferences.
You remember the first writers conference you went to, and what year it was?
First writers conference I went to was the one in San Diego. It's the Southern California Writers Conference, and it was in 1990. It was 92 or 93.
That's crazy. That's the first one I ever went to.
No,
yeah, it was. It was not. It was probably about 12 years ago. So it was like 2006 or something. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I have a.
Yeah, but I thought you meant that when you went to the same one in 93.
Oh, No. I was doing drugs and stuff back then. I wasn't writing or anything. it was kind of a full circle for me because I got to give a little talk at 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, so that was pretty cool. And those guys did a great job down there.
Very nice.
Yeah, you should see the check. It's unbelievable.
lots of zeros.
Oh, my God. Nothing but. I know you lead a writer's group in Temecula, which is where you live. How many different genres are in the group?
Oh, there's women's fiction, sci-fi, fantasy, historical, and crime.
There you go. Do you feel that it's beneficial for you to hear critiques from people that read different genres? Do you think you can learn something from them, or do you think that, wow, they just know what the hell we're talking about?
No, without a doubt. People in our writers group have really improved the quality of the Bruno books.
That's kind of close-ended. Well, that's good.
We try to focus on craft and try to develop an ear for craft. And it doesn't matter what genre you're writing in, craft is craft.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with it, but. So who are some of your early influences?
Early on, I read, this, I think the first book that really just grabbed me was Treasure Island. But then I read everything. Wow. I read Alistair McLean, Wilbur Smith. I had a spate of Westerns. I read all of Louis L'Amour, Luke Short, Max Brand. Then later on, I got into John D. McDonald, Michael Conley, Robert Kreis. I read quite extensively in the crime novel area.
When do you think that you developed? You wrote, like you told us, 38 novels before you got published, and you went and sold 34. When do you think you developed? How long did it take you to develop your voice?
To me, the voice is the big kahuna. That's the everything. And I didn't realize that until I think the second book in the Bruno series. But what happened, I think, was that I shifted from a standard mystery construction, which is an odd number of scenes in a chapter, and you have 28 to 30 chapters for the book, to a single scene per chapter with 50 to 60 chapters in the book, and it makes the story run faster. And I think that the reading public now, they want a more immediate gratification in their reading. And I think that's what the thriller structure gives them. So you have a broader audience to shoot for. And I think once I shifted to that construction, that's what triggered it.
Interesting. So you still start writing every day at 3:30 in the morning, or is that just something you made up to create a mystique?
Well, you know, when I was working full time, I was too tired to write when I got home, so I would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'd write for 3 hours, and I try to write 1,000 words every day. Go back 20 pages, edit forward to get the voice and the language and the syntax going the same, and then I would write 4 more pages. And once I retired, I still get up, and my wife gives me a hard time because she goes, "No, you don't." But mostly, I get up at right around, average is probably still 3:30. Sometimes I get up at 1:30, sometimes I get up at 2, sometimes I get up at 4, but I'm always getting up and working on my book.
I'd be tempted to call bullshit on that, but when I read some of the times that you send emails to me, I can verify that you're at least up at that time. I'm not.
Yeah, well, usually I don't start emailing you until I got my 1,000 words in. It's usually like at 5 o'clock, I think.
No, you give me sometimes in the middle. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. But, okay. Yeah, sometimes when I can't sleep, I wonder what the hell you're doing. So we're into the writing process a little bit. You already said you're a blank pager or a pantser. But still, you got to start with an inciting incident. So beyond that, what comes first for you? Is it character or plot?
I had drilled into me by my mentor, and he always told me, story is not story, character is story. So I think of, when I write a scene, I think of the best way to display my character, not the best way to display the story.
Oh, that's nice. I was waiting for some more genius, but that's actually quite good. Who was your mentor? Who was your mentor?
I have several mentors, but...
Well, you just said your mentor.
Oh, my mentor, that mentor. His name is Jerry Hanna. He was the... a professor of creative writing from San Jose State, and he ran our read and critique group I jumped into it 23 years ago, but he had been running it probably 15 years before I got in there, so he'd ran that thing for 35 years. Some great authors came out of his group.
Wow. So I talked to you one time about revision, and to you it kind of seemed, like craftish to me. Because you say every day you go back 20 pages and you revise. So my understanding, at least it used to be, after you've done that through your first draft, basically the book was done. Is that still true?
Yeah, I always know where I am in the book because of the structure I try to stick to. I go to the four C's, conflict, complication, crisis, conclusion for my overall story arc, and then there's 5 things I put in each scene. And that's the other thing that I changed up with the Bruno book. I was doing it wrong, I thought, that my conflict was too long. I thought the conflict was supposed to be longer, and it wasn't. So once I shortened my conflict and jumped right into my complication, along with that thriller structure, that's when I think I started hitting it in the publishing world. So to answer your question, I get up in the morning and I write. I know what my conflict's going to be. Well, as soon as I get out of my conflict, I'm into my complication, and I go back that 20 pages. So I'm going over everything at least 4 or 5 times before I move forward. So I'm editing and rewriting as I go.
Sure. Conflict, complication, sounds like a math problem to me. So you had a very colorful childhood, which to me
that was a nice transition.
Surprising.
Nice transition. Yes,
we're running out of
time. I did.
We're running out of time. I'm trying to get all your shit in here. So I
didn't think it was a colorful childhood. I thought it was a normal. Everybody else had the same childhood I did until I started talking to people like you, and you go, "You did what?"
I had a very cushy childhood. So give us a story about your mom.
Oh, well, she was a very influential person in my life when I was growing up, and she, my dad was very creative, and he was a deputy sheriff, and at the time he'd come home, and instead of writing, he would build stuff in the front yard, and he built a barbecue that was probably 5 feet tall, and it was a volcano, and it was painted fluorescent colors, and then he had these jungle-type plants around it, and there was a 6-foot native in the front yard with a spear and tiki masks on the garage wall, and so when he barbecued, the smoke would come out of the volcano. Well, the city gave him a ticket for being a public nuisance because the cars driving by would rubberneck and crash into each other, and so they made him take all that stuff down. But my dad divorced my mom when I was 6 years old, and so my mom was single with 4 kids. So, and she grew up, she had a very hard life growing up. She left home when she was 14. So she put us kids to work all the time. And she would do some unique things with food. She would take us night farming. She called it night farming. Come on, kids, let's go night farming. And we would go pick corn and water and stuff. I thought that everybody was doing that. On St. Patrick's Day, she would drive through McDonald's because they had 15-cent green milkshakes. And she would say, "Give me 70 milkshakes." And the guy in the drive-thru would say, "70? You want 70 milkshakes?" She goes, "Yeah, 70 milkshakes." And then we'd come through, and they didn't believe it, but, 15-cent milkshakes, she'd buy 70 there, then she'd go to the next McDonald's and buy another 70, and then she'd put them in the freezer. We had a big chest freezer that she won on Cream for a Day when she was on Cream for a Day, and she would freeze them, and those were our popsicles for the entire summer. For so $25, she kept us happy. You just tear the wax cup off, and then you have ice cream.
She's brilliant. I want to go back to night farming, though, because clearly when you guys go out night farming, you'd be picking corn and everything. But you had your own farm in the backyard, huh?
No, it was we drove a little ways.
It was community property.
You what?
It was community property.
Well, no, it wasn't. I think it belonged to somebody else.
Okay, all right.
I got shot at twice.
What? Holy crap. You want to explain that?
Well, as I got older, I realized that it was against the, against the rules. But we'd be night farming, and somebody would come out with a shotgun full of rock salt and pepper us.
So I see where your need for adrenaline came from.
I thought everybody was night farming.
Sure. Yeah. That's amazing. What about the strawberries?
She was driving by one day in this strawberry field. They were going to turn it under. And she goes, wait, no, don't turn it under. And she went and got all the kids and the Belvedere station wagon. And she put the seats down in the station wagon and put in these blue plastic tablecloths. And she filled that station wagon all the way to the top, from the driver's seat all the way back to the back window. And then we got them home and put them in a big pile, like a 3-foot or 4-foot tall mound of strawberries in the living room. And then us kids had to pluck them off. And then she would cut them up, put them in plastic bags, and put them in the freezer when the milkshakes weren't in there. And we had, she made strawberry pie and strawberry syrup for years out of that stuff.
That's amazing. How nasty were some of the strawberries?
You what?
How nasty were some of the strawberries?
Well, they were good. All the strawberries were good. Yeah. We didn't put any ratty or damaged strawberries in there. They were all pretty good strawberries. I don't know why they were turning the field under. But she didn't want, she couldn't see that kind of stuff going away, so she enlisted all her slave labor children to help her.
We know where your work ethic came from. So I'm going to give you another segue, okay, so you can make some comment about it. So you worked at the Southland, as going back to a good television series, L.A. area and San Bernardino for a long time. And then you decided to move to Hawaii and catch a little bit of the Aloha spirit. Was that a how jolting was that change for you?
Huge, huge change for me. I did 28 years total in Southern California, and my last assignment was internal affairs. I didn't want to go to internal affairs. In fact, they called me like three times, and the captain, the undersheriff, was talking to the captain, trying to get me to go. Finally went, and didn't like the job at all. It was a horrible job, probably the worst job I ever had in law enforcement. So I was miserable. And after a year, I was messing around on the computer, saw the opening in Hawaii, just applied for it, and I got an interview. They hired me, and I was the only Howley out of 50 agents in Hawaii, the only white guy. So it was definitely a unique experience. Hawaii doesn't have any post office, peace officer standard of training. So there didn't seem to be any oversight by the state for the way things operated, which in California, it was very strict rules and regulations. So it was fun and it was unique.
Yeah, well, how did your can-do attitude go on over there? It's really good, but from what I've heard from you, is it had a little bit different work ethic or time for the way time
yeah,
than you did.
They immediately started calling me. My nickname was Mr. Law Enforcement because I'd do a case and get a warrant. I'd tell my boss, "Hey, I'm gonna go kick this guy's door in and take him to jail," and my boss would go, no, we don't do that here. We call them up and have them come in. I go, you do what? And they go, yeah, we don't go out after them. We just call them. Call a guy up and tell him Friday at noon, so we'll have them all come in that week at that time, and we'll arrest everybody at the same time. And that was another kind of culture shock for me because it's an island. Everybody knows everybody else. And, you know, how in California, it's 6 degrees of separation. There, it's like a half a degree of separation. Everybody knows everybody else.
Didn't your one of your superiors tell you to kind of slow things down because you were too efficient or you cleaned up something?
Yeah, you're trying to get me in trouble here. I was used to a faster pace, and I was carrying 28 cases, about an average of 28 cases when I was in internal affairs. And I get there, and they give me three or four, and I do them real quick and ask for another, and my peers came to me and say, hey, we like that you're doing this, but do the cases and hold it for a month, then turn it in. And I said, well, I can't do that. I really can't do that. So I continued at the usual pace, and my supervisor came to me and said, hey, you know, you keep working like this, they're gonna hand you all the cases. And I said, I don't care. I don't mind doing it. So I started getting a lot more cases. I started having a lot more fun.
Go kick some doors down. So how many years did you work for 5-0?
Just under 3 years.
And
my wife was born and raised there, and she had, all her relatives were there. And so we stayed at her dad's house for a while until we found a condo close to work. And then I think the humidity more than anything else kind of ground me down.
Sure.
It's fun visiting Hawaii, but then when you deal with the humidity, walking around doing investigations day after day, it just grinds on you.
No wonder they're slow down over there. So after you retired, did you tell yourself, well, I'm going to become a published author now, or is that just something you just continue to write because you've done it before, and then
no,
the idea of actually becoming...
We moved back to Southern California, and my wife got her job back at the company she was working at, and she didn't want to drive, so she drew a radius around her work, and she goes, I'm going to have a five-mile drive. And we found a house based on that circle around her job. So now she works 3 miles from our house. She has one signal, and it's nice. But the house that we bought just happened to have 5 acres of avocados, and I thought, you know, I'll just go into full-time avocados. So we bought another grove of 11 acres, so we had 16 acres total. And I'd still write and continue writing I'll be an avocado farmer, organic avocado farmer. But then I got so busy once Ocean View picked up the Bruno series that I sold off the other grove, and I actually leased out just recently this grove that we live on.
Okay, so your expertise as a cop and as a writer now, what is the most common mistake mystery writers make regarding police procedures?
Oh, you know, I wish I'd write some of
those. I know it is on TV movies.
And, you know, everybody talks about the gun, the safety on a gun. That's acceptable. But one of the big ones that kind of irks me is the clip. And that I guess it's been said so much that it's become a clip. But there's only one clip. The gun, the clip came about at the M1 Grand in World War II, where the internal magazine of the rifle, the bullets were on a clip, and you would shove the clip with the bullets into the gun. And then when they fired the last bullet, the clip pinged out and the breech locked open, and you'd shove another clip in. Well, then everybody coming back from World War II called the magazine for handguns clips, and they're not. They're magazines. The other thing is...
Go ahead. No, I said it's fine and interesting, but you're wrong. That's not the most common mistake. But, you know, I guess you have some expertise.
Okay. How many times do you hear people refer to a clip and a gun?
The clip. They already said that people came back from World War II. The biggest thing, and at least movies and TV, is that everybody walks around the crime scene.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, if it's historical, they used to do that. When I was just starting out, everybody would come into the crime scene, and then they started getting dinged on it in court, and then they started putting the logs up. I started in 1979, and I'm telling you, we didn't have that kind of thing back then. I've been to several hundred homicide scenes.
I bet you have. How many are you responsible for? Never mind. all right, so we're getting down nitty gritty. Somehow we filled up an hour, which is kind of unbelievable. But just about every author I know has a funny or embarrassing book signing story. Do you? And I don't want to hear a good one. You have an embarrassing one or a funny one?
My wife and I were invited to a book signing at a library in Koreatown in Los Angeles, and we showed up. It was a nice big library, and they had this huge room, lots of chairs set up, and the librarian said, I got to go. I got something to do. I'll be back after it's over. And two people showed up, both homeless, taking shelter in the library. And I sat and talked with a couple of homeless people about Bruno Johnson.
How many books did they buy?
Nothing. I actually gave them $5 for something to eat.
Oh, you're such a softie. So I'm gonna give you a much better one. Okay, so and I'll be quick. We were at LA Times Festival of Books last year. You and I actually did a panel together in the rain, right? In the raining sideways. So I'm sitting there. Well, we had name tags in front of us. So a woman walks up to me, and she says, "You're Matt Coyle?" And this was my second book was out. And I thought, they know me by name already. I've made it. She goes, yeah, I'm Matt Coyle. She goes, don't go anywhere. My sister loves your books, and she has the latest one. She wants to come. I want to grab her and make sure you sign it. I go, I'm here. I'm waiting for this. I'm kind of feeling pretty good about myself. And so I see the woman come back dragging her sister up. Her sister looks at me, and she goes, you're not Michael Connelly.
Oh.
Swear to God. Swear to God, that actually happened to me. L.A. Times Festival of Books. My two worst signing stories were L.A. Times. But anyway, so before we go, you already told us what was coming up next. But so on book five, which is in, do you have a date yet for publication of the prequel to Bruno and a title?
No, but if it goes according to the other ones, it'll be the first week of February.
First week of February? And is there a title yet?
That was an issue, too. I'd given them those two prequels names, and the publisher didn't like them, so they changed the title. I think this one is going to be called The Innocence, though. Innocence with a T.
We know that Bob and Pat are probably listening, so that's probably the best title you've ever heard of, isn't it?
It is, actually. It was much better than what I thought of.
Yeah. I agree. All right, so how do people find you on the interweb?
DavidPutnamBooks.com.
What about, are you on, you're sort of on Facebook, although you don't post much, so you're on Facebook, right?
Right.
And you do a little bit on Twitter.
Yeah, okay. My wife set that up for me, and Facebook and Twitter at the same time.
Maybe we should talk to her. What's the Twitter? Do you have a Twitter handle?
What is it there?
Dave Putnam.
What's that? Is it just Dave Putnam?
Dave Putnam, yes.
There you go. Well, next time, we'll talk to Mary. and get the real story. Dave, I appreciate you coming on. Mary, I appreciate you holding up the key cards. I think we're done, and I'm going to roll it over to Pam, and thanks for letting me have this time to break your show.
Thank you very much, Matt. This was fun.
I love this show. I love the fact that Dave has no idea where he is in social media, which is why I always message Mary whenever I want him to come on the show or need something. So thank you, Mary Putnam. And Dave is under Dave Putnam Author on Twitter, but it turns out at Dave Putnam. I know because I just tweeted. And you can find Matt Coyle there, too. Matt, I can't thank you enough for hosting the show tonight. Please come back and do it again. And Dave, I don't know, are you ready to host a show yourself?
I'm a little shy, but I'll try it.
That's Mary.
Yeah? So maybe I need to have the Putnams on to host a show.
Can we do that? Can we have two?
Yes, we can. We can, because because Mary is not shy at all.
No, she's not.
I like her. I love Mary. She's great. You guys have a really great night. I will be talking to you both again soon. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
Good night.